You're listening to the Experience Points Podcast, episode number 191 for the week of October 3rd, 2012. Welcome back to the Experience Points Podcast. My name is George Albor.
I'm Scott Juster.
And we are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net, a site dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of games and culture. And sometimes, Scott, we get games that are serious and cultural.
Oh yeah, it's getting super serious.
Super serious. Today on the podcast, we are talking about a new game recently released by a Montreal-based studio called Minority. And this game is Popo EO. And Scott, you and I saw some of Popo EO at E3 this year.
Yeah, not to sound like a huge hipster or anything, but one of the standouts of one of the hidden gems of E3.
It certainly caught our attention, and one of the reasons it caught our attention, and I think one of the reasons it caught really the mainstream games industry's attention at all, is because it's very explicitly about a serious issue. This is a game about something, and the thing that it's about, and I don't think this goes into spoilers at all, is a young child who is dealing with a alcoholic and abusive parent. And the simple metaphor is that the child encounters a monster during the game, and this monster is a metaphor for his dad. If the monster eats certain things, like lemons, it'll fall asleep and it could be useful. And if it eats frogs, it turns into a fiery demon and messes up the main character by attacking it.
Yeah, it's the in-game activity is kind of like a metaphor when the kid escapes his day-to-day life and goes into this more magical realm.
It is set in a sort of Brazilian favela atmosphere. Yeah. Which I really like that quite a bit. You don't get a whole lot of games set in, I guess, sort of like poor areas. Like, poverty is not really an issue in most games. There are, of course, games set in favelas, but usually they're involved shooting Brazilian police or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not only... Well, it's weird. We should talk about the cultural mashup in a little bit, but just the allusion to the huge, large-scale South American favelas is striking, but also equally striking is that the game doesn't make a huge deal out of it.
Right.
Whereas, like, in, what was that, Modern Warfare 2 or something, the favela level?
Yeah.
And then the recent Max Payne 3, it was kind of front and center, the inherent, danger and seediness of it. This is just, it's presented as is. You know, there's not a huge amount of commentary on it, and there's nothing. I mean, there are special things about it, and there's magical things going on, but it's not used to shock. Basically, it's kind of mundane in a way.
It's also interesting because for the most part, when we see favelas in other games or movies, they're noticeable because they are so labyrinthine, right? They're so confusing, and while this is a puzzle game, it's really navigable. It's not, you don't get lost in sort of favela streets. There's large open spaces. There's a sense of familiarity. And then two, the game features some excellent graffiti art in each level. So you'll turn a corner and on a wall will be this gorgeous piece of colorful art. And it really sort of livens up an atmosphere where traditionally we see it as sort of dirty and gross and confusing.
You think of that, the stereotypical slum pictures, and it's almost like they kind of put a black and white or a sepia tone on everything just to make it seem dingier.
Yeah.
And this one, you really notice it because in certain parts of the game, the colors do fade away for other kind of non-environmental reasons, and you notice it once you get outside again, and all of a sudden there's green, there's trees around and stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
So where should we start off? I guess, what we should tell people whenever we talk about a game specifically, we'll spend, about 10 minutes or so talking about the game generally. So in case you care about the story and don't want to know about it before you play it, you'll have a chance to listen for a little bit. And then we'll warn you before going into specific plot details.
So I guess I think it would be interesting to start with some of the contention that I think you linked to recently, an article by Drew Dixon, and I think you wrote about it as well, but the game's difficulty.
Yeah.
Because the very basic idea of the game is you need to get from point A to point B. It's a simple puzzle game, and there are objects in the level that you can move around to facilitate that, and then there's some platforming elements.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's some backlash in the sense that the game's not difficult enough,
mm-hmm.
because it's not a hard game by any means.
Right.
So, I mean, how do you weigh in? Do you think that it's just as easy as it needs to be? Do you think that there's room for more difficulty?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's always room for more difficulty, but what people don't realize is that difficulty is not just a slider that exists in a vacuum. You know, right. Even if you don't change the plot or the characters or the art, changing the difficulty fundamentally alters the game.
Yeah.
By the way you interact with it, and you know, this game, like you were saying, there's puzzles and you have to think about them a little bit, but I would say it's far less confusing than something like Portal. These are like Legend of Zelda style puzzles. You know, press a switch, something opens up, you see a button at the top of the hill, you have to figure out how to get up that hill, press it, and then the thing opens up, you know?
Right.
Very kind of like A to B to C style puzzles.
Yeah. I kind of like the feeling that I found the solution to a puzzle quickly and efficiently. You know, like, all of the solutions are very parsimonious, right? If you start thinking, oh gosh, maybe I need to go this way, maybe I'm messing up, you're in the wrong direction already, right? You don't accidentally find a solution more. I mean, sometimes you accidentally find a solution and that you'll run up to a lever and just pull it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's not a lot of times in which you're so stuck that you start doing things that you're not, you know, that you find confusing or that you're not used to.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I didn't think about it in that way. There's, in many puzzle games or adventure games, especially adventure games, you start, you know, clicking on things randomly just to see what happens. And by paring the puzzles down, it removes that randomness.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and you know, the game is very story-heavy, and I think that's, pretty much essential to keeping people focused on the story, because if they get too caught up in the puzzles, this is what I talked about in an article, like, if you get too caught up on the puzzles, then you start losing the narrative thread, because you either get frustrated, or you just want to stop, or, you start looking at the game as, you know, not as much of a story, and more of, you know, a series of challenges. You know, you don't want to turn it into Geometry Wars, basically.
Right, yeah. And I guess, I mean, the one thing is that thematically speaking, it's not easy to navigate a sort of an abusive relationship with a parent.
Right.
So I could imagine the game being a little bit more difficult knowingly.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to that end, I think it does do a good job of adding some of the difficulty that is directly related to the father-son relationship. In the fact that, you know, sometimes when you have to get past the monster when he's on fire, it's incredibly difficult. Right, like he will just throw you over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a sort of sense of difficulty and frustration when you're forced to physically move past your metaphorical father.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the other thing about the environments and the monster within them is that, you know, if you press a button or pull a lever, the game is actually like one of the few games I can think of that goes into, that would fall into like the magical realism territory, that's more popular in literature and movies, where everything's presented in a realistic, artistic way, but there are, you know, chalk and graffiti lines that turn into, you know, moving gears and levers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something is like based in reality, except there's also like huge frogs that the monster can eat and then get mad.
Yeah.
So even though the puzzles aren't necessarily obscure from a design or a mathematical perspective, because the game is set in this magical realism milieu, you know, you never know what's going to happen when you start turning a gear.
Yeah. I think, you know, that's, yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but I think that's a really good way to put it.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge fan of magical realism, so I think that that makes sense.
Isn't it weird how it so rarely shows up in games?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is really weird. I think partially because as players, we want one or the other, right? We want super realistic or we want a fantasy world. Whereas yeah. that sort of in-between is, it's kind of, one, I think it's somewhat difficult to actually pull off. Mm-hmm. And two, I don't know if there's a really, I mean, even magical realism in literature isn't like, you know, this isn't 50 Shades of Grey here, right? Like, it's not incredibly popular.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so strange because video games are, like, specifically a medium where you're not constrained by the physical world, and you're, and players are almost primed to expect weird and unexpected things.
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea that you can press a gear that's made out of chalk on a wall in this game, and all of a sudden the favelas will, you know, start stacking up on top of each other, mm-hmm. or like a chunk of the ground will just kind of open up like a book or something.
Yeah.
It's just neat. You know, not a lot of games do that, and I think it's effective for what Papo EO does because clearly the game did not have a huge budget, and it definitely did not have a huge team. You know, like they're yeah. working within specific limits.
And they did a really good job of keeping those magical moments consistent. At certain intervals throughout the game, I would do something and I would go, wow, that's really cool. That looks really cool. That's a really clever way to go about doing whatever I need to do. If it's, yeah. you know, when the buildings move and stack up and then you can move the entire row of buildings, or mm-hmm. You'll turn a switch and a building will grow legs and start moving off, yeah. or just open up. Or turn as though it's like two buildings are part of a book and you're opening the spine. Mm-hmm. Right? There's all these really cool moments that are visually appealing and really create this sort of sense of magical that
yeah.
I think really adds to the experience.
And I think that's why it's also important that they had the favela setting the whole time, because yeah. if someone was in that, if you're in that sort of situation, then you know, you can look at it one of two ways. You can look at it as, you know, oppressive, or, you know, hopeless, or you probably look at it both ways depending on how you're feeling that day. Or you can look at it, you know, there's an escapist aspect to it, there's a hopefulness aspect to it, and it makes a lot of sense because the way those cities are designed are, you know, like the clustered aspect of them is mm-hmm. just, you know, pure practicality, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then like juxtaposing that with the, you know, the magic that kind of defies any kind of law or planning.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, it's really powerful, and it's more powerful to me than if you're just in like a pure fantasy realm, because everything is contrived anyway. You know?
I completely agree. Well, shall we get into spoilers?
Yeah. I mean, like, I guess before we jump into spoilers, there, you know, we're saying a lot of really good things about the game, but I think it's important to note how, and, you know, I don't mean this in a terrible way, but, like, this game is kind of rough in spots. Like, yep. it is an independent game.
I fell through the world at one point and had to restart.
Yeah, yep. I mean, like, stuff like that might happen. You know, the controls are not as good as something like Super Mario Brothers. You know, like, you're going to be doing a lot yep. of jumping and a lot of, like, running around, but you will sometimes feel a little floaty.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, that was something that I was kind of getting frustrated with a lot of critics with when I was reading other people's reviews after I had finished mine, because, you know, the game isn't about speed runs or collecting 120 stars or, you know, online leaderboards.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it tells a story that almost no other mainstream game on a major console does. And yet people couldn't figure out how to really evaluate it. You know, should we evaluate this as like, you know, on the tightness of its controls or what it says? You know, I chose to kind of look at it holistically rather than, you know, piece by piece. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's a judgment call, but it's something that I think draws attention to something that is just going to become a bigger and bigger problem with game reviews going forward.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's my soapbox thing.
Okay.
Spoilers?
Spoilers. Let's do it. Spoiler right, time.
Yeah. Okay.
It happens.
Okay. So, how'd you feel about this whole metaphor?
You know, it's not something where I feel like it's very heavy-handed, because mm-hmm. you know right from the get-go that this is what the game is about, you know? Mm-hmm. It doesn't hide its colors. It's an obvious metaphor. Mm-hmm. You know, when you start throwing lemons around and then it's like, oh, I'm getting drunk and I'm going to fall asleep.
They're now. Melons, by the way. Or no, they're coconuts.
Oh, coconuts, that's excuse what they me. Are. They look like lemons because they're giant.
They do
kind of
look like lemons.
Yeah, they're melon. They're coconuts. But that being said, it's a game about something, and that is pretty rare, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of times, our excuse for playing a game is that, hey, our protagonist is being shot at, shoot back.
Yeah.
You know, that for the most part, that feels like the motivation of our main characters. Mm-hmm. The motivation of this character is to help their father or overcome the sort of difficulty in their life and their relationship. One, it's rare to see anyone tackle a subject that's serious like that. Including alcoholism. Maybe Kane and Lynch, maybe? Like, there's so few. And two, it's a story about a child, but it is in an adult game. That's incredibly rare.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, I get that some people think, oh, this is heavy-handed. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel that way, simply because it's so unique.
Yeah, I mean, it gets away with it because I think one, it does it earnestly. Like it keeps that. It keeps Kiko's perspective. Kiko's the main character. It keeps Kiko's perspective for the whole game. It doesn't, you know, wink at the audience or try to get, or, you know, on the other end of things, it doesn't try to have a huge message for like all people to follow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's a very personal game. And you can, it feels that way throughout the entire experience.
I mean, it's rare enough for a designer to explicitly address the players. You know, the opening screen is Vander Caballero's dedication to his family.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's rare for that, for a designer to like kind of break the fourth wall in that way.
Yeah.
You know, usually games are presented as these magical boxes that you only see who makes them at the end.
Yeah. And it says in the credits, you know, like it thanks his parents and sister who also survived the monster or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the transitions were pretty interesting. You know, I saw, obviously, it's clear where the game is going early on, but the way that Kiko changes over the course of the game, I thought was pretty cool. You know, at first, when he starts losing his school uniform,
yeah,
I thought that was a glitch at first, I have to admit. Like, I was like, oh no, my character model's glitched out, and now I've lost my jacket and tie or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you lose a shoe, I think. And then you lose your shirt. So you kind of, you're becoming, you know, part of this world. You know, you're not like a kid of, you know, the regular 20th century anymore. You're part of this, you know, tribe of lost kids that lives in this fantasy world.
Yeah. And you get the chalk body paint.
Yeah. Just like, you know, there's a little girl that kind of acts as your guide for most of the game. And she's, you know, mocked up in the body paint and the chalk lines on her arms and everything.
Yeah.
And eventually you become that.
It's also interesting because in the beginning of the game, she almost seems more like an antagonist. Like she teases you and, you know, there's not a good relationship there. And then
she tries to stop you too.
Yeah. And then at the end of the game, as you're becoming more like them, more like her, it's camaraderie, right? Like it's almost like a sister or a really good friend.
Mm-hmm.
I get this weird sense that, you know, so much of the game is about like coming to terms with your reality, right? Like having to deal with an issue in maybe not in the way that you expected. And I think the sense that he's losing his clothing, he's sort of a proper kid and becomes this person that is half naked and covered in chalk like war paint is, I think, another good metaphor of changing to becoming something that you need to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was pretty powerful. And you know, I read an interview with Caballero, and he was saying how inspired he was by Ico, like it's his favorite game or something.
I definitely felt that as I was playing. While I was playing, I thought that, and then I thought to myself, I probably shouldn't mention that in the podcast because I'm always talking about Ico.
No, I forget what interview that I read this in, but he, you know, he named it specifically. But you know, while I was playing the game, you know, you get into this mindset, or at least I do in video games, where, you know, the protagonist and anyone who aids the protagonist are always going to be kind of good guys.
Yeah.
And so I was waiting for the monster to be affectionate in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I fell into this trap of I thought the monster was like kind of like my friend. But then I realized as I played the game more and more, even when the monster wasn't enraged, it wasn't very friendly.
Yeah.
You know, like, he didn't really help me out. He could only be bribed into helping, basically.
Well, so there's one moment, though, that I think does a really good job of this, right? Mm-hmm. It's maybe like halfway through the game, and there's a puzzle where you fall into the ground, mm-hmm. and the walls start coming at you, mm-hmm. and you have to look at, it's basically like a ball and cup game.
Yeah.
Right? The knobs are moving around, and you have to select the right one, otherwise you'll get crushed by the wall.
Mm-hmm.
If you fail, and the wall's about to crush you, the monster reaches down and picks you up, mm-hmm. and then while he's holding you, he, like, shakes his head, and then just sort of sets you down gently, and then goes back to his thing.
Huh.
So, like...
I don't think I encountered that, actually.
I mean, if you didn't fail that, you won't encounter it. But for me, it was a really touching moment, because you get the sense that even within this monster, who for the most part doesn't care about you and for the most part is alcoholic and abusive, mm-hmm. there's a little piece of him that loves his son, that wants to protect his son.
Yeah. Know?
And even shaking his head of like, no, don't do that, is almost like a fatherly thing, right? Like, that's a really mm-hmm. nice touch of telling your kid, don't do what you just did. You could hurt yourself,
mm-hmm.
even though you yourself are like a bad and physically abusive influence.
Man, I need to go back and get into that situation again, because it's too bad that I missed that.
Mm-hmm.
So when the monster eats a frog, which is the stand-in for alcohol, he bursts into flames and starts just wrecking stuff. But you can never fail the game.
Right.
So how did you feel about them handling like the consequences for when monster would get angry?
I thought they were good. I mean, I don't know. It's tough because to some extent there is a sense that when this person is being abusive, it's not that they want to kill you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that, you know, they want to give you a game over by literally, like, breaking your neck. It's mm-hmm. it's they want to take out their anger in some way, mm-hmm. right? And the sort of little blue coconuts, I thought, was one of my least favorite, because it's not entirely clear what that is or in what way Kiko has the power to calm his father, right?
Yeah, it was the most game-like portion, I think, you know? You know, the magic token that ends the level, basically.
Right. But other than that, I mean, I thought it worked well, the consequences.
You know, the other cool thing that, you know, and this is something that a lot of standout games do, is that you traverse the same areas multiple times, but in different contexts. Like, mm-hmm. if you've altered the environment, the next time you go through a certain neighborhood, it'll be a little bit different. And there was one section in the game where you have to make a series of, like, six jumps over some favelas that are suspended kind of high up over the air.
Yes. Yeah.
And then, you know, you go and do your thing, and then the monster gets enraged and you start running the other direction. And you have to do the same series of jumps, except that the monster is now beneath you, kind of like pacing and jumping and lunging at you. Yeah. He can never really touch you unless you fall all the way down, but, you know, the idea that the monster is down there and that, you know, knowing that if you mess up your jumps, you'll have to go down there and get, you know, torn up by him.
Yeah.
It was really powerful because it showed how context and how behavior is affected by potential things that can happen.
Yeah, definitely.
And even if, like, you know, your skills don't change. And just like anyone who's in an abusive situation or in just a stressful situation, like, your base level of skills are still there, but trying to perform when you have so much stress is, you know, totally different from someone that doesn't have that stress.
Yeah, it's like, don't wake alcoholic daddy.
Yeah, it is. Like, and I forget, you know, there was a recent, you know, they always talk about this in the school system in America. You know, the kids that have hard home lives, you know, are so stressed out that it affects their, you know, their performance in school.
Yep.
It's not that they're innately dumber or anything. It's just that their minds are always in the fight or flight mode, basically.
Yeah.
And when you're and it was just a really elegant metaphor in the game, because if you have the pressure to make all of those jumps because you know that it's going to be real bad if you fall rather than just inconvenient, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, like, I grew up in a household that was you know, it's less than perfect, to put it mm-hmm. lightly. So, you know, a lot of the scenes in this game I thought were really powerful, especially to me, and it felt right in a lot of ways. And that mm-hmm. that level was one of my favorites for that, precisely because of what you said, with the sort of feeling that he's beneath you, right? That you could piss him off in some way.
Yeah.
I also think they do a really good job of the frogs becoming this thing where at first it's hey, they're a little cute, mm-hmm. And they're like a tool. But yeah. So in that level in particular, you have to turn keys to get three buildings to move into position for you to use them as pathways towards the exit. And every time you move one of those buildings, a frog comes out. Mm-hmm. Right, and your monster father will rush towards the frog, and you have like precious moments to take that frog and throw it against a wall to get rid of it. Right, mm-hmm. Otherwise it'll reset the houses, and you'll have to start all over.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it does a brilliant job of recreating that sense of like of panic around the idea that this person might get pissed off. Right, this mm-hmm. person, like, if I don't do something right now, the father figure is going to get alcoholic and fiery and attack me, mm-hmm. you know? So like it's weird because when you're in that sort of abusive relationship and you see the things that lead towards that, right? Like alcohol is a stepping stone towards an abusive relationship or yeah. towards changing someone. And the way that you see the frog in the game from the game mechanics itself, I think is a pretty accurate way of actually seeing alcohol in those relationships.
Mm-hmm. Because it's something that is, I mean, obviously the frogs are bright. They're one of the brighter things in the game.
Right.
And they're also kind of, it's hard for Kiko to control them because they're always jumping out of his way
mm-hmm.
and really attractive to the monster too.
Yeah. I mean, there's a sense of panic and fear when you see a frog, you
yeah.
know? And
yeah.
When you see a bottle of alcohol sitting on the table and you're like, oh gosh, my dad's going to be home at like 6 or something.
Yep.
You know, it can elicit that same fear and trepidation.
Yeah. How did you feel about Lula? Lula is the robot action figure that Kiko has in his real world. And when he goes into the fantasy world, it becomes like a larger, like jetpack enabled style robot.
I dug Lula. I thought, both Lula and the girl, Lula was a nice touch because the game can be a little lonely. And, you know, when you're in an abusive relationship, like you will make up friends, like you will do whatever you can to not, you know, to have that sort of escape from that situation. Mm-hmm. And I think if it wasn't for Lula, the first half of the game would be a little bland and not as yeah. entertaining. And two, yeah. just mechanically speaking, it works. When you and I were at E3 and we played the demo level, that felt less tight than the game mm-hmm. did. So I think they really fixed up some stuff
mm-hmm.
Between then and now.
Yeah.
And I think Lula is much better now as well.
And they actually take a while, you know, to kind of establish Kiko and then establish your relationship with Lula and then, you know, do some more platforming and then introduce the monster. Like, they're very patient as to how everything builds up.
Mm-hmm.
And once I realized what they were doing, I got really scared because your only friendly face in the game, and you're facing this monster that tends to destroy everything that's in his path. I was like, oh, Lula,
yeah,
Lula, you better watch out, Lula. And you know, lo and behold, what happens? You know, she gets smashed by the monster.
Yeah,
I was actually somewhat surprised that they had you revive Lula.
Mm-hmm.
Because I figured that would be like a large sacrifice.
Yeah.
But then, you know, they outsmarted me because at the end of the game, they yank it out from under you again.
Yep.
I think the end of the game was probably my favorite part of the entire, maybe that jumping puzzle that we talked about earlier. But
yeah, that was one of my favorites. But yeah, the ending is fantastic.
I think this is why the reviewers get weirded out, because it's not challenge based at all.
Yeah.
The only thing you have to do is tell Lula to stay. You know, Lula has to press a button in order for you to progress.
Yeah.
But the minute he or she, I forget if Lula's a he or she, but the moment that she stops pressing the button, the puzzle stops moving. So you have to abandon her. You know, she has to sacrifice herself for you to go forward.
I was playing the game with Nicole next to mm-hmm. me, and I told her when that happened, I was like, that was awesome. I loved that because
yep.
it's a perfect example of a visual storytelling. Because, you know, Lula puts his hands in the puzzle to make it move, leaves, and you sort of see, and there, you know, Lula's a child's robot. There's no expression on the face. All you see is just eyes and like a tiny little figure. He moves, notices that the thing stopped moving, goes back, looks back at you. There's sort of like this realization, oh no, I'm sorry. Like, I have to stay here to have you keep going. And like a sacrifice, right? All done without words. Beautifully done. Gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that whole sequence where you're on the gondola with Monster kind of going towards the ultimate end that you've been told, you know, there's like a shaman that could possibly cure Monster of his curse or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you're just kind of like sitting on this gondola up the mountain where, you know, supposedly you might be able to help out. And it's just a quiet moment, you know, you're just standing there and you're listening to the music and
which
you're
is
watching.
Great music, by the way.
It is like I hadn't really heard anything about it until I played the game, and you know you're just standing there. You just and you know for once in the entire game, Monster is tranquil but not asleep. You know, like he's awake, but he's not enraged. And you just kind of get to look at him and you see him sitting there, and he's kind of a pathetic figure. You know,
and that moment felt to me like, if any of the buildings that you occupied were their home, that was their home.
Yeah.
You know, and for a moment, and there's a wall of wood separating you, right? So there's a sense that like Kiko is still hiding from him for fear that he'll piss him off. But there's a level of intimacy between the two that is really cool, especially because it comes after so many bad experiences with the Monster.
Mm-hmm. And you know, this is again where they're not, you know, they're not nervous at all about hammering home the metaphor.
Mm.
And, you know, it's a case-by-case basis, but in certain, you know, in certain cases, it's completely warranted. You know, like, it is completely on the nose that you pass through a bank of fog and Monster turns into a guy. You know, he's just a man sitting there. And then changes back once you pass through another bank of fog. But it's because you rarely get something that's so unflinching, you know?
Yeah, totally. I mean, and then, you know, you get to the scene when you actually have the shaman, and Kiko sort of realizes that all of this is a form of escapism, that there is no cure for his father, which I'm really glad they did that. Not only because I think that the message, I think, it really sticks with me, but also because I think there's a general temptation in games to say, yes, you did find the magical shaman. Yes, you did achieve X. The goal that you set out to achieve has been accomplished.
You always save the world.
Yeah, you always save the world, and that doesn't happen. And you know, it doesn't happen in children's lives, and it doesn't happen in adult lives. So it's really, it's obvious, you know, when you start turning to things, and oh yeah, of course the monster is your alcoholic father. Of course, it's a little shocking, you know, like there's a scene when you're rotating these statues of the monster, and then it becomes the father. Right, slowly and gradually, and you see the father like holding up a belt, like beating Kiko. Right,
yeah.
No matter how many times you tell yourself that you're completely aware that that's what this whole relationship is. This is all a metaphor for an abusive father. Like, it's hard to look at something like that. You know, it's hard to think about like strong and physical child abuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially in games where that's, I said this in one of my articles, but like even Rockstar doesn't touch that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you know, the game is so blatant because of that, I think. You know, because it's rarely discussed and it doesn't want you to be able to escape from it.
Yeah.
You know. And at the end, you know, you have to like help Monster like destroy himself, basically.
Yeah.
Like, it's just the saddest thing. Like, you pour frogs into the
put alcohol bottles
and then the frogs turn into alcohol bottles, like literal alcohol bottles, and you know, he gets enraged and the fire basically consumes his entire environment.
Yeah, which is a natural progression, right? Like, that's what it does to families, that's what it does to communities.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're reaching this point in video games where people are realizing that the interactivity is just as important as the challenge, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so that very ending sequence where the monster is, you know, he's spent basically, and he collapses and he's on the cot that you've pushed him around on through the entire game. And you're the one that has to end the game. You know, it doesn't go into a cutscene there. You have to like physically, you know, deal with what you're going to do with the monster.
Mm-hmm. Pushing him off the cliff.
Pushing him off the cliff, and then, I don't know, like, what did you interpret that as? I thought it was kind of like a acceptance sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in people in abusive relationships, like, as they grow up, especially people who've experienced child abuse, I think so much of their lives is dominated by that, you know? Like, people who lived a normal, happy childhood, right? They grow up and go, oh, yeah, so much of who I am today is defined by those adventures I had over the summer. I went to camp, horseback riding, you know, like, all these fun stuff. that's just as true for people who were beaten, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think there comes a point in someone's adulthood where they have to let that go and become someone who is now defined by their own actions, you know, who they define themselves. They have to sacrifice the idea that, like, you can salvage a relationship with someone, you know? Like, you can't always do that. Sometimes someone is just too far gone. The game designer, Cabrera, was that his name?
Caballero.
Yeah, Caballero. Yeah. His father's dead now.
Yeah.
And I've read a couple interviews with him saying that, you know, it didn't really come across that there was a sort of regret. I never got the sense that he wishes that he could have talked to his father and settled it down, you know, because at some point doing that is, you know, confronting someone about an abusive relationship is more traumatic to the victim than it is to, you know, than it is.
Yeah, than it is to healing.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Sometimes you're better off just saying, I'm going to move past that. I'm going to put that behind me and become someone else. And I think that was really powerful to me. I almost, you know, there's this last bit after you push the monster off the cliff, as you walk towards the sort of very end of the game, and it looks like you're sort of going down almost like a closet. Is that what you felt it was?
Yeah, it was something like that.
And I wasn't sure what that was. Like, you know, is that, I almost kind of wish it were more clear that,
because I think that's where the game started. Like, he was hiding in the closet from his dad.
Yeah.
So I think it was kind of just like looping back around, you know?
I wonder if it would have been better if Kiko had been an adult at the end. Like, if we had seen him as an adult. Because I don't know, I get the sense that it's really cool that he did that. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how often a child can do that. I mean, Kiko in the game is what, like 8?
Yeah. I mean, it's to make that, I mean, it's a really strange distinction, especially in like the video game context, because you're like, you know, you're beating the game, or, you know, you don't, when you're done like playing Papa Wii, you're not like, yeah, I won, awesome.
Yeah.
You know, like but you've definitely accomplished something. Mm-hmm. And so that's a hard thing to, I think that's a hard thing to convey, and it's a hard thing to make sure that you're able to explain, like, how the child dealt with that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. I think just the general tone of it, and like the music kind of, and also, you know, the game ends with kind of a white light, and, you know, Kiko is a bit more relaxed, so it, you know, it hints at it, but yeah, you're right. You know, it doesn't, there's no like, and they lived happily ever after type moment.
Which is fine. Like, I don't need that. I mean, even after that, I kept going back and forth. Do I wish there was more so that we sort of get to see the repercussions of that decision, which, you know, is a momentous decision, you know? Like, this is something that, you know, I sort of went through similar things in college, and it is a profound moment when you decide, I am sacrificing a relationship with this person in my life, you know? So I kind of wish there were more to be seen. At the same time, I understand that any of that, we can kind of imagine what that could be like, right? We can we could sort of put ourselves in Kiko's shoes and think about it from that perspective. I mean, I love the fact that this game ends with a victory that is not, you know, you don't leave this as like, yeah, I'm super happy about that.
Yeah, it's not a heroic tale.
That's pretty rare in games, you know? Like, to think back to Ico for a moment, right? Like, Ico ends and the protagonist is completely unconscious, right? Like, it is a victorious moment, but it's also like a sort of calm and quiet victory, right? This isn't a victory, in Ico at least, of some profound achievement. It's one of like, rest. And I get that exact same sort of feeling from the end of Papa Wii-O.
Yeah, definitely. Good. Well, I'm glad that you enjoyed the game, because I always get worried when I tell people that I really like a game.
Yeah, hey, I feel the same way about The Walking Dead, so.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, do you know what other games Vander Caballero worked on before this?
I don't.
Army of Two.
Are you serious? Wow.
I am completely serious.
He has the Brazilian experience.
Yeah. But I mean, it's just, on like a quick side note, this is why the independent scene is important.
Hell yes.
Because this guy did, he worked on both Army of Two games. Would you ever in a million years think that someone who worked on those two games would work on something, would be the creative driver behind this?
We're two bros, like, fist bump every time they, like, kill guys. Yeah, no.
Yeah, I mean, so, like, I love AAA games, I love independent games, but they definitely need each other, because one, you know, either one will subsume the stories of the other.
Can I also add, this is why Sony, in a lot of ways, is freaking awesome.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that someone comes up with this, like, who, can you imagine what that meeting must have been like?
I know.
Like, oh, hey, so I have this game. It's about being beaten by your alcoholic father. And they're like, well, yeah, like, we can sell that. PSN,
Vander, let's go. Vander, you've done it again.
Like, that, this is not a game that should exist, really. You know, like 5 years ago, if someone was like, oh, someone's going to make a game and it's about an alcoholic abusive father, I'd go, oh, indie game, maybe on Steam if you're lucky. You
know? Yeah.
This is
a
game, it's on the PSN. Like, you could buy this for your PS3. Like, that's kind of amazing.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's nice to see a breakout title from a new studio, too. And, like, clearly this was, like, a labor of love, and, you know, they did a lot with what little they had. And so I think this was, like, a nice proving grounds for them.
I agree.
Whatever else Minority does going forward, then I think it will be even more, like, impressive from a technical perspective.
And I certainly hope they do more.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of human relationships that have not been tapped in games. Clearly.
Well, I mean, he's already done half as many. He's already led. Well, he personally, since he's done Army of Two and like a few other games, you know, he's already shipped far more games than Fumito Ueda. So if Minority comes out with one more game, they've already done as many as Shadow of the Colossus and Ico. So they're on track.
Win.
All right, we will wrap it up there. As always, if you have any comments, questions, suggestions, experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And experiencepoints.net is our website. You can also leave your thoughts there in the comment section to this post. We update that site Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday evening, so come on by.
All right, until next time, everyone. Thanks for listening, and take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Go to